In our new series, World War II's Greatest Battles, we chart five pivotal moments that shaped the course of the conflict with military historian James Holland. New episodes drop every Thursday on the History Extra podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. Throughout history, societies have been captivated by the idea of evil women. But why? This is something that Professor Joanna Burke has been exploring in a series of Gresham College lectures. The lectures, which are free to watch at gresham.ac.uk, examine figures from Eve in the Bible to Myra Hindley to explore what they can tell us about society at the time. I spoke to Joanna to find out more. Your Gresham lectures interrogate the idea of the evil woman from Eve to Myra Hindley. So some of the women that you look at are mythical, some are fictional, and some are historical. So when you were thinking about which women to include in a series called Evil Women, what were the parameters for inclusion?
When I started to think about what I wanted to talk about here, you know, there's so many things I could have chosen. There's so many really quite obvious ones. For example, the role of women during the Holocaust, you know, watching and participating as their neighbors were taken to labor and extermination camps. I was also thinking of, you know, the role of women in the wars in the former Yugoslavia and how they were very, very involved in the torture camps. I could have chosen, you know, the women in, for example, the Democratic Republic of the Congo during that conflict, where something like 40% of the rapes that took place actually involved women as perpetrators. So there was a huge range of things I could have looked at. And in the end, I decided to take really just six kind of different kinds of evil that women participated in or were involved with. And so these are broad categories. So as you say, I started with, you know, I had to start really with the original kind of evil. I mean, Eve, who brought sin into the world, brought death into the world. So she was an obvious one to start with. Then, of course, I moved to, well, witches, a very big category of evil. And I chose here the sort of evil queen in Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. Then monstrous evil. I mean, people don't know about her very much. Amelia Dyer, she was responsible for the killing of around 400 infants in Victorian Britain. So this kind of monstrous evil, sexual evil, Mata Hari, responsible allegedly for the deaths of around 50,000 French soldiers through her treachery. So this is the treacherous sexual woman. Institutional evil, Nurse Ratched and One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. And then radical evil, the sadistic sexual killer, Myra Hindley. So these I thought were kind of representative categories. And I think the other thing here is I had to think really carefully about what I actually meant by evil.
This is something I wanted to ask you about, because we should say before we go any further, you're not using the word evil unquestioningly here, are you? How do you think that we need to deconstruct that term to understand it better?
Absolutely. I mean, the whole series of lectures problematize and question the way we talk about evil in itself, let alone female evil, because every generation sort of reinvents what they think is evil. And I think that's one of the reasons why this is so particularly interesting. And my kind of evil, I'm not interested really, at least not in this series, of natural evils or those sorts of, you know, like earthquakes or great natural disasters. I was interested in evil as as human agency. So my kind of evil is about what people do to harm other people. But of course, I problematize that. And throughout, every lecture asks, well, this person or this figure was designated evil. Is that really how we want to think about this woman?
Why do you think we've been so obsessed with evil women through history? You only have to look at tabloid papers, for example, to see how intrigued and horrified and captivated we are by women who fall into the category of, quote, evil.
We are fascinated with evil women. We're fascinated much more so than evil men. And I think one of the reasons for that is they not only do or allegedly do bad things, but they are transgressive. They transgress the fundamental issue of what we think popularly as femininity. And this makes them really, really intriguing. I think the other reason we are obsessed with evil women is because evil women, or our designation of certain women as evil, is really at the heart of the control of women within society, of patriarchal norms. So it's very important to keep women in their place. So we label certain women evil. We set them outside the feminine. We set them outside the human. And this enables us to then look at other women and say, just you be careful, because you could be next. And I think that is also why we're so fascinated by this concept.
What are some of those gendered things, that are some of the most evil things that women can do in the Western world?
The most evil thing that a woman can do in different periods of history is break the norms of femininity, sort of cut through what they're supposed to be doing as women, as nurturers, as helpmates, as servants, as inferior individuals to men, and usurp some of that power that men are supposed to be the exclusive owners of. A good example here, I think, is the evil queen in Snow White. Because why is she considered so evil? She is considered so evil because she's taken some of the power that men have. She roams the world freely. She is active. She is an agent. While Snow White is sort of the simpering little girl in the original story, remember, she's 14 years of age, the simpering girl who, you know, is really happy to do all the housework and to look after all the boys and all that sort of thing. She stays at home and cleans and cooks, whereas the evil queen roams the world. The evil queen is also very interesting because she not only usurps male powers, but she actually uses female or traditionally female ways of nurturing people in ways that are meant to be harmful. So she tries to kill Snow White four times. Firstly, she tries to get a man to do it for her. Typical woman, you know, here. Second, then, you know, she uses three things that women do to nurture. She uses the stays on Snow White to try and suffocate her. She combs Snow White's hair with this hairbrush that has formidable powers. And then she feeds her this poisoned apple. So these are traditionally womanly ways of nurturing. And yet, of course, she's using it for evil purposes. So she's really very interesting in that sense. And I think there's one other thing about the evil queen and Snow White that I think is really important. And that is that she's menopausal. She's this ancient old crone. She is the woman who is set outside what a woman is supposed to be. And, you know, we were talking a few minutes ago about, you know, the questioning of this evil thing, because one of the things I think I want to argue in my talk on the Evil Queen and Snow White is that who's really evil in that story? In that story, the real evil thing is actually that shimmering mirror, the misogynistic mirror who tells this beautiful, powerful older woman that she is ugly and therefore incites all this jealousy and this cruelty.
It's interesting because that's quite a kind of empowering take on this evil woman. But some of the women you look at, I think, would be more problematic to offer a different perspective on. So I'm thinking of the women, especially who are involved in murders. So Amelia Dyer, particularly, who was a baby farmer, and Myra Hindley. I guess for each of these cases, you're applying a different lens in how you look at them.
Amelia Dyer is probably the woman I look at who's less familiar to people today. But at the time, in the late 19th century, she was widely known, and her name was sort of synonymous for female evil, the woman who kills innocent babes. She was born into a decent, well-off, I mean, not rich, but well off. She trained as a nurse, and then she married a man who was considerably her senior, who was extremely violent to her, beat her up many, many times. Today we would call her a battered woman. And she left him many times. And in order to make ends meet, she became what was known at the time as a baby farmer. So in other words, she would take in infants and look after them for a small fee. Most of these infants, nearly all of these infants, in fact, were born out of wedlock. So their mothers were desperate. Their mothers could not take care of their children, these infants. So they would give her to baby farmers like Dyer, who would then look after them. Now, these babies had such incredibly high death rates, something like, 3 or 5% survived. In most cases, the baby farmers would simply neglect them. So they would give them morphine, so they slept all the time and were not hungry. And they basically eventually died. Now, Dyer was different to most because instead of slowly killing them, a very painful death of these young babies, she would take them and usually the same day strangle and kill them, drown them. And, there was huge furore when one day, a number of these bodies floated to the surface, and they started investigating her. She was eventually hung for what she did, but a very famous case, and really the shock and horror of this evil deed that she had done was very important in late 19th century and early 20th century movements against cruelty to children.
Do you think that's why her case caught fire in the way it did, because it reflected anxieties of the age about the treatment of children at the time?
Her case excited a huge amount of attention because it coincided with the establishment of the Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Children. It's very interesting here that the Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals was established 50 years before this. Okay, so it took 50 years for a similar society to be established for the prevention of cruelty to children. And funnily enough, or perhaps not surprisingly, the Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Children actually modeled itself explicitly on the equivalent society for animals. And indeed, the first case that was brought to court, the actual infant was actually described as a little animal. So it coincided, the discovery of these bodies coincided with something was already happening in late Victorian society at that time, this realization that children were needed to be protected, that children suffered pain. Today we take it for granted that in fact children, infants, experience pain. But in fact, even the top scientists of the 1870s and 1890s did not actually believe that young infants actually experienced or felt pain. They thought it was just when a child cried. They thought it was just a reflex action, like it was, they believed, for animals. So this coincidence of increased interest in the sentience, the ability of infants to feel, the development of a very powerful organization defending the rights of children. And then, of course, her killing all these children. And incidentally, people knew that this was happening. So it was also exposed, this huge problem of baby farming, that infants were being killed, and actually a lot of people knew about it. So it kind of opened the gates for a real panic about the children, particularly the children of the poor.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
Every generation creates evil in different periods, and this really can tell us a lot about the status of women, the fears of women, and the ability of women themselves to challenge the societal pressures and constraints that they face.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Each of the women that you choose to look at here, you're talking not just about the women, but what about what reaction to them can tell us about society at the time. And if we move forward to World War One, we get to Mata Hari, who was kind of branded with a real particular type of evil, a very sexualized, exoticized evil. What can you tell us about her life in reality and the way that the story of her life was constructed, which were two very different things?
Yeah, I mean, Mata Hari is really interesting because, she's so different from the other women I speak about. Extremely intelligent, exceptionally beautiful, active, determined to live her own life. Like many of the women who are branded evil, she also married a man who was violent to her. She was a battered wife as well. She was forced, therefore, to make a living herself in a context where there weren't very good jobs for women. And she's regarded as evil because she used her sexual charms, she used her very eroticized dance in order to allegedly entrap men and spy for the Germans. And this was, when she was caught, she probably did do some spying, actually, but probably very insignificant in terms of what she was able to, what she's able to pass on. But, she was accused of being responsible for the deaths on the battlefield of 50,000 French soldiers. This was a period where the French were experiencing the most devastating defeats during the First World War, 1917. This was the lowest period for the French army. And here was this beautiful woman who was seen as profiting from the deaths of 50,000 soldiers that year, French soldiers that year, by using her sexual charms. It also fed into these broader concerns about women generally during the First World War, that, women were taking jobs, stealing the jobs of young men who were dying and being mutilated on the battlefields, that women were profiteering from all of this. So she was a brilliant scapegoat for these underlying anxieties about women in war and the highly sexualized, powerful woman.
The image that Mata Hari created of herself was very exoticized as well. Did that play a role in the way that she was seen?
Absolutely. I mean, Mata Hari invented a persona. She invented this Eastern, orientalized woman from Burma. And
what was her real background, do we know?
She was Dutch. She was Dutch-born. She spent time in Java with her first husband, again, who was very, very violent. But she was very Dutch. And it's really interesting that the commentators during her trial also orientalized her. They talked constantly of her dark skin and her oriental background, even though they knew fully well that she was Dutch, white Dutch. They played into this. But I think the orientalizing of Mata Hari was actually part of her seductiveness, but it was also part of her downfall, because it castigated her as somehow, dark, primitive, animalistic. And these things, these huge racist things, which are deeply embedded in French society at the time, were used against her when she came to trial.
Which is so interesting and complex in the fact that that was an image that she created for herself, and everybody was aware of that fact, but still played into those tropes when they wanted to talk about her. It's very confusing somehow.
Yeah, and one of the things that I'm very interested in all of these lectures is to look at the really prominent role that is played not only by gender, by femininity, and going against feminine norms, but also racist agendas and racist tropes that actually are applied in all of the cases that I'm looked at at various levels. I mean, I think more so in the Mata Hari case than many others, but it is, an underlying issue with all of the evil women I talk about.
So I might just circle us right back around to the beginning now, because I do want to ask you about the foundational evil woman that you discuss, Eve. How have biblical stories about Eve shaped perceptions of women throughout history?
If there is one woman who has been labelled evil and is an underlying presence in particularly Western society, it must be Eve. She, right from the beginnings to the present, she is the typical evil woman. She is everything that a woman shouldn't be. And I think she not only brings sin into the world, but she also corrupts man. She corrupts all of humanity. She has been used to oppress women throughout the centuries. You just have to, you just have to think about the church fathers who use the image of Eve to show and to suggest that women should not or cannot have positions of power. Women cannot speak in church. Women should not be educated. Women have to be under the thumb of the head of the household, the male head of the household. She is the exemplar for female oppression. And that continues to this day. You look at go back in history, we're talking about the church fathers. You can look at the witch hunts in the early modern period, where Eve was the central thing there, that these women were following in the footsteps of Eve. And there's sort of an impossible tension with these women. I mean, not all of the witches were women, but the vast majority of witches who were killed were women, mainly menopausal women. And on the one hand, they were seen as bringing the inheritance of Eve into that period of history, corrupting men, being duplicitous, and feminine and weak, the vessels who the devil could enter because precisely because they were weak vessels. But on the other hand, they were all powerful witches. They had the ability, like Eve had, of corrupting everything in their surroundings. So this weakness and yet all powerfulness, which coincide in the image of Eve. And I think that's what makes her really the essential evil woman.
So moving forward, one of the other really intriguing figures that you look at is the archetypal evil nurse, Nurse Ratched from One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, who stands as a kind of mechanical, clinical, surgical evil, I would say. Do you think that reactions to the character of Nurse Ratched can tell us something about concerns of the post-war West specifically? Do you see it as grounded really in the time that it was created?
Yeah, Nurse Ratched is definitely grounded in very specific fears and anxieties about women. It's all about the Cold War. It's all about matriarchy taking over, and that men, as a consequence, are being emasculated. They're being lobotomized. They're being not only genitally castrated, but they're being mentally castrated as well, which of course is what happens to Nick Murphy. And these are all about fears of what was called at the time of momism. So a very, very famous and very influential book, which was published in the in 1947 by Philip Wiley, which is all about the post-war fears of moms, of mothers. So momism is something that he railed against, and this book became a bestseller, about we need now to put women in their place because we are becoming like we, meaning men, are becoming like women. They are taking away our power. The post-war problems that men coming back from the Second World War, that women had taken their jobs. Again, this kind of reminds us of Mata Hari after the First World War. They'd taken our jobs, that boys are becoming effeminate, great fears about homosexuality, the role of the powerful mother who is smothering her male children. On the one hand, there's the momism thing, which the novel in particular is really reflecting. On the other hand, there are concerns about the role of psychiatry. So this notion of the total institution, the Goffman total institution, where there is nowhere to escape. There is no freedom. There is no frontier. There is no, men out there hunting and wandering about in the wilderness or in the forests or whatever, that everything has become this total institution of total control, that people are really frightened of. And psychiatry, and particularly the anti-psychiatry movement of the time, is actually also reflecting this. And this is very, very important in the novel in particular, but also, of course, in the filmed version.
So each of these women reflects a big old melting pot of fears from the time that they were either created or they lived. This question, it might throw you off a bit, but I'll throw it in and we'll see what happens. But if you were gonna do a lecture in 30 years about an evil woman that encapsulated the time we live in today, what do you think that she might look like?
I think I've got a negative response to that, because I'm very worried about our current position with the rise of real powerful feminist movements and Me Too, hashtag Me Too. I think, women accusing powerful men of sexual abuse and sexual harassment. I think that I do worry that in the future, people may look back and say, these women were actually hurting men. So it's a kind of 21st century momism fear that I have. And So I fear a backlash against powerful young women today who are talking out against this sort of casual misogyny that we see in current society.
I think finally, just to give a concluding note, what would you want people to take away from these lectures? I mean, loads of people have already tuned into them. You can get them for free on the Gresham site. But if people listen to all six, what do you hope that they leave with?
I hope they are left with a curiosity about the past and a curiosity about what it is that we fear in our society and how we then sort of map our fears onto individual women and castigate them and stereotype them and cast them out from our society. I think one of the things I found just particularly exciting about doing this work is that looking at evil women really opens up the history, our history, in particular women, the history of women and the ways women have in different periods of time been oppressed and how they have fought back and how they have challenged that their designation of evil, how they've challenged the accusations that they are not behaving in what is correct or in a particular feminine way. I mean, as I said at the beginning, you know, we all create evil for every generation creates evil in different periods. And this really can tell us a lot about the status of women, the fears of women, and the ability of women themselves to challenge the societal pressures and constraints that they face. And I think that's why I've enjoyed doing this series.
That was Joanna Burke. Her series of lectures on evil women are available to watch at gresham.ac.uk. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt, Jack Bateman and Brittany Colley. Tune in tomorrow for an episode on how Henry VII fought off the pretenders to his throne.